The story of the slow rise of the Hohenzollern family, which ruled the Kingdom of Prussia from inconspicuous beginnings, is too tedious and unimportant for us to follow here. It's a story of luck and violence, of bold claims and sudden betrayals. It's told with great appreciation in Carlyle's Frederick the Great. By the 18th century, the Prussian kingdom was important enough to threaten the empire. It had a strong, well-drilled army, and its king was an attentive and worthy student of Machiavelli. Frederick the Great perfected his Versailles at Potsdam. There, the Park of Sanssouci, with its fountains, avenues, statuary, aped its model. There also was the New Palace, a vast brick building erected at enormous expense, the Orangery, in the Italian style, with a collection of pictures, a marble palace, and so on. Frederick carried culture to the pitch of authorship and corresponded with and entertained Voltaire to their mutual exasperation. The Austrian dominions were kept too busy between the hammer of the French and the anvil of the Turks to develop the real grand monarch style until the reign of Maria Theresa, who, being a woman, didn't bear the title of Empress, 1740 to 1780. Joseph II, who was emperor from 1765 to 1792, succeeded to her palaces in 1780. With Peter the Great, 1682 to 1725, the Empire of Muscovy broke away from her Tatar traditions and entered the sphere of French attraction. Peter shaved the Oriental beards of his nobles and introduced Western costume. These were but the outward and visible symbols of his Westering tendencies. To release himself from the Asiatic feeling and traditions of Moscow, which, like Pekin, has a sacred inner city, the Kremlin, he built himself a new capital, Petrograd, upon the swamp of the Neva. And, of course, he built his Versailles, the Peterhof, about 18 miles from this new Paris, employing a French architect and having a terrace, fountains, cascades, picture gallery, park, and all the recognized features. His more distinguished successors were Elizabeth, 1741 to 1762, and Catherine the Great, a German princess who, after obtaining the crown in sound Oriental fashion through the murder of her husband, the legitimate Tsar, reverted to advanced Western ideals and ruled with great vigor from 1762 to 1796. She set up an academy and corresponded with Voltaire, and she lived to witness the end of the system of grand monarchy in Europe and the execution of Louis XVI. We can't even catalogue here the minor grand monarchs of the time in Florence, Tuscany, and Savoy, and Saxony, and Denmark, and Sweden. Versailles, under a score of names, is starred in every volume of Baedeker, and the tourist gapes in their palaces. Nor can we deal with the War of the Spanish Succession. Spain, overstrained by the imperial enterprises of Charles V and Philip II, and enfeebled by a bigoted persecution of Protestants, Muslims, and Jews, was, throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, sinking down from her temporary importance in European affairs to the level of a secondary power again. These European monarchs ruled their kingdoms as their noblemen ruled their estates. They plotted against one another, they were politic and far-seeing in an unreal fashion, they made wars, they spent the substance of Europe upon absurd policies of aggression and resistance. At last there burst upon them a great storm out of the depths. That storm, the first French Revolution, the indignation of the common man in Europe, took their system unawares. It was but the opening outbreak of a great cycle of political and social storms that still continue, that will perhaps continue until every vestige of nationalist monarchy has been swept out of the world and the skies clear again, for the great peace of the federation of mankind. Sixth, we've seen how the idea of a world rule and a community of mankind first came into human affairs. And we've traced how the failure of the Christian churches to sustain and establish those conceptions of its founder led to a moral collapse in political affairs and a reversion to egotism and want of faith. We've seen how Machiavellian monarchy set itself up against the spirit of brotherhood in Christendom, and how Machiavellian monarchy developed throughout a large part of Europe into the grand monarchies and parliamentary monarchies of the 17th and 18th centuries. But the mind and imagination of man is incessantly active, and beneath the sway of the grand monarchs, a complex of notions and traditions was being woven as a net is woven to catch and entangle men's minds. The conception of international politics, not as a matter of dealings between princes, but as a matter of dealings between a kind of immortal beings, the powers. The princes came and went. A Louis XIV would be followed by a petticoat-hunting Louis XV, and he again by that dull-witted amateur locksmith Louis XVI. Peter the Great gave place to a succession of empresses, the chief continuity of the Habsburgs after Charles V, either in Austria or Spain, was a continuity of thick lips, clumsy chins, and superstition. The amiable scoundrelism of a Charles II would make a mock of his own pretensions. But what remained much more steadfast were the secretariats of the foreign ministries and the ideas of people who wrote of state concerns. The ministers maintained a continuity of policy during the off days of their monarchs and between one monarch and another. So we find that the prince gradually became less important in men's minds than the power of which he was the head. We begin to read less and less of the schemes and ambitions of King this or that, and more of the designs of France or the ambitions of Prussia. In an age when religious faith was declining, we find men displaying a new and vivid belief in the reality of these personifications. These vast, vague phantoms, the powers, crept insensibly into European political thought until in the later 18th and in the 19th centuries they dominated it entirely. To this day they dominated. European life remained nominally Christian, but to worship one God in spirit and in truth is to belong to one community with all one's fellow worshippers. In practical reality, Europe does not do this. She's given herself up altogether to the worship of this strange state mythology. To these sovereign deities, to the unity of Italy, to the hegemony of Prussia, to the glory of France, and the destinies of Russia, she sacrificed many generations of possible unity, peace, and prosperity, and the lives of millions of men. To regard a tribe or a state as a sort of personality is a very old disposition of the human mind. The Bible abounds in such personifications. Judah, Edom, Moab, Assyria figure in the Hebrew scriptures as if they were individuals. It's sometimes impossible to say whether the Hebrew writer is dealing with a person or with a nation. It's manifestly a primitive and natural tendency, but in the case of modern Europe, it's a retrocession. Europe, under the idea of Christendom, had gone far towards unification, and while such tribal persons as Israel or Tyre did represent a certain community of blood, a certain uniformity of type, and a homogeneity of interest, the European powers, which arose in the 17th and 18th centuries, were entirely fictitious unities. Russia was, in truth, an assembly of the most incongruous elements, Cossacks, Tartars, Ukrainians, Muscovites, and after the time of Peter, Estonians and Lithuanians. The France of Louis XV comprehended German Alsace and freshly assimilated regions of Burgundy. It was a prison of suppressed Huguenots, and a sweating house for peasants. In Britain, England carried on her back the Hanoverian dominions in Germany, Scotland, the profoundly alien Welsh, and the hostile and Catholic Irish. Such powers as Sweden, Prussia, and still more so Poland and Austria, if we watch them in a series of historical maps, contract, expand, thrust out extensions, and wander over the map of Europe as amoeba do under the microscope.